This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. By the standards of the past week, it's been relatively calm in Egypt today. Some protests continue. The army took a more visible role on the streets of Cairo, and President Hosni Mubarak replaced several government ministers and issued instructions to institute reforms, but the changes were dismissed by opposition leaders as much too little and far too late. Various groups called for massive protests tomorrow. Foreign nationals, including many thousands of Americans, are trying to leave as quickly as possible amid great confusion at Cairo International Airport. In a moment, an update from Cairo. We'll also talk with a former ambassador and find out more about the different groups on all sides of this crisis. Later in the program, the neighborhood in northern Manhattan that became the mecca of Black America, Sharifa Rhodes Pitts, on her new book, Harlem is Nowhere. But first, what are you most concerned about as the situation evolves in Egypt? Our phone number, 800-989-8255, email talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation on our website at npr.org. Just go click on Talk of the Nation. Hannah Alam is the Cairo bureau chief for McClatchy Newspapers. She's in Cairo and joins us by phone from there. Good evening and nice to have you with us today.
Hi there.
And is it is the relative calm continuing into the evening there?
It is so far. I'm keeping my office windows open, and I can still hear chanting in the distance. But so far, it's calm. Today, the police came back. It was a very subdued police force, many of them not even wearing uniforms, and definitely appearing very chastened after the violence of the past week in which, you know, several police stations were torched and taken over in this popular uprising. This time, though, the military is there. People still respect the military and are welcoming them. So far, so good. Tomorrow is going to be a key test with the protesters planning this big march. They're hoping for a million-strong march toward the presidential compound at the edge of the city. So we'll see how that goes.
News agencies are reporting that an army spokesman said this evening that the army would not take action against the Egyptian people. What does that mean?
Well, that's what everyone's wondering. That statement came out. It's been repeated and talked about very much here in all circles. And people are taking this. Protesters I've spoken to tonight are saying that that's sort of a green light for them to go ahead with this very risky march toward one of the most sensitive sites in the entire country, the presidential compound, as well as in the same area. There's a whole lot of defense headquarters and sensitive defense installations there.
Have we got any idea yet whether the opposition has coalesced into any kind of structure?
It's still very loosely organized, very fluid. It's hard to pin anyone down on that. But certainly today, as in previous days, all sorts of Egyptians were out there, from Islamists to communists to just young people hoping for economic and job opportunities out of this, who want change. I mean, Mubarak's been president since many of them were infants, if not before. And so it's really the spectrum of Egyptian society out there. Whether that sort of coalescing will hold if their common goal of overthrowing the president, once that's achieved, if that's achieved indeed, then the jockeying begins, and we'll see how strong these alliances are.
And so, as I understand it, there's supposed to be a meeting tomorrow morning to discuss this idea and in fact, whether Mohammed al-Baradei, the former head of the IAEA, the International Atomic Energy Agency, whether he would be acceptable as sort of a group spokesman.
Right. That's what we're hearing. Certainly, views are mixed on Baradei. They, some people say, look, there's no one else. There's sort of no other national figure around whom everyone can rally for the moment, so he's going to have to take some sort of interim position here because of the absence of anyone else. I mean, this is not a place where, I mean, if you're a national figure with any sort of following, you're quickly silenced. So, you know, on the other hand, he's built his constituency from abroad mainly, and people do view him to some degree as a Johnny-come-lately who sort of waited to see how the protests were going to pan out in the early days and then arrived to take on a leadership role. So views are certainly mixed, but from the people I've talked to so far, he seems to be acceptable as some sort of interim figure, if for no other reason than there's no one else to do the job.
Well, the other someone else might be somebody in the military, and indeed a former head of military intelligence has been named number two in the government today. Are people concerned about that?
They are. I mean, people want to see a civilian-led government. That's something that's been repeated again and again. And although people like Omar Suleiman and others are viewed perhaps as, I mean, less, I don't know, sinister or corrupt than some of the other people in Mubarak's inner circle, I mean, this is still a person who's very much part and parcel of the regime and has been so for a long time.
Is there an idea that this regime is going to be robust and able to withstand repeated calls for its ouster and the departure of Mr. Mubarak, or is this something that could end as quickly as the situation in Tunisia did?
Well, it's hard to say, but I mean, in Tahrir Square, people are saying they're going to keep it up and they will not accept anything short of Mubarak's resignation. Outside of Tahrir Square and the jubilance there, the situation is more dire, and it grows more dire by the day as there's, you know, gas lines and shortages on bread and other basic goods, and of course, lots of ransacked shops with untold millions in property damage, and people are there's fear. I don't really hear anyone from any quarter coming out saying Mubarak stay, but I think people are worried about if he goes, what happens on day two.
And, of course, that's unknowable at this particular moment. We've heard numbers of just under 100 people killed, many hundreds injured in these protests that have continued now for just about a week. And, indeed, you mentioned a lot of damage and various places have been looted and other places burned. Any idea whether those numbers are realistic?
For the casualty figures?
Yeah.
Yes. We've seen some of the, I mean, dozens of corpses have been shown on television channels, regional television stations, especially Al Jazeera, which, by the way, Al Jazeera English had its office closed and journalists arrested, probably because of these and other images that are getting out. So I witnessed firsthand some really violent clashes in Suez earlier this week, and I don't find those casualty figures incredible at all. I think, if anything, they could be underreported.
Let's see if we can get a caller in on the conversation. Let's go to Roger. Roger with us from Milford in Michigan.
Hey there. I just want to comment on how similar it seems to be to the Shah of Iran, whom we supported during a time. There were multiple factions calling for his ouster. But because we alienated that population by continuing to support him or not calling for him to resign, the fundamentalists end up taking over. I think a similar thing could happen in Egypt if we don't more openly embrace the protester movement and give some credibility to us and giving less ammunition for groups, more organized groups like the Muslim Brotherhood to be the dominant political power.
The Muslim Brotherhood, the fundamentalist group that has been relatively moderate in past years, but has also spawned some of the ideologues who inspired Osama bin Laden and Ayman al-Zawahiri, his number two, who is, of course, a product of the Muslim Brotherhood. For more on that, let's bring another voice into the conversation. Daniel Kurtzer, former U.S. ambassador to both Egypt and Israel, currently a professor at the Woodrow Wilson School of Public and International Affairs at Princeton. He joins us from a studio on the campus there. Nice to have you with us today.
Thank you, Neil.
And does this play out for you like 1979 Tehran?
I think there are fundamental differences. The army in Egypt remains the most important corporate entity, the bedrock of legitimacy In Iran in 1979, the role of the army was quite different and would not respond when the Shah needed them to respond towards the end. And that, of course, points to a reality in contemporary Egypt, which is that as the army decides, situation will unfold. I think the army until now has tried to moderate any kind of government reaction to the demonstrations. We've seen scenes of, in fact, cooperation and friendship on the streets. But you need to remember that this army is also quite dedicated to the idea of stability and the preservation of law and order, and quite concerned about the possibility that groups like the Muslim Brotherhood could turn a popular demonstration into an Islamist victory. So we need to watch the army very carefully in this situation in Egypt.
And indeed, some would say you need to watch the Muslim Brotherhood as well, a very organized group, a very disciplined group, in part because of their resilience and after many decades of crackdowns by various regimes in Egypt over the past 30 years, of course, the Mubarak regime. But there was a wide group of people protesting the Shah in Iran, yet it was the hardliners who eventually took power.
Exactly right. Look, the Muslim Brotherhood's been around since 1928. And they've been adept enough to adopt tactics that measure up to the times. When necessary, they've gone underground. They have allowed their members to run for parliament, although not under the banner of the Muslim Brotherhood. They sat on the fence last week and waited until midweek before deciding to join these demonstrations, having suffered a rather significant setback in the parliamentary elections in November. But they have a goal, and that goal is to have an Islamic State replace the current regime in Egypt. And I think it's important that we remember that. This is not a benign organization within society.
Daniel Kurtzer, former U.S. ambassador to Egypt. He also served as an ambassador to Israel as well. Also on the line with us from Cairo is Hannah Alam, the Cairo bureau chief for McClatchy Newspapers. As the situation continues to evolve in Egypt, what are you most concerned about? Give us a call, 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. Stay with us. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. I'm Neil Conan. It's nighttime in Egypt, and in Cairo, protesters continue to gather in Tahrir Square in defiance of a curfew. For almost a week, there have been large protests in the capital and other cities with calls for President Hosni Mubarak to step down. Protesters cite years of corruption, a brutal police force, and economic disparity. Our guest is Daniel Kurtzer, a former ambassador to Egypt and to Israel, a professor at Princeton. Also with us is Hannah Alam, Cairo bureau chief for the McClatchy Newspapers. We want to hear from you. What are you most concerned about as the situation evolves in Egypt? 800-989-8255. Email talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation on our website. That's at npr.org. Click on Talk of the Nation. There's an email from Daniel in St. Louis. I'm most concerned, at least from a standpoint of how this affects America and her interests, about missed opportunities. I sure hope America takes official measures in this situation that are modeled, such as to improve our image in the entire region of the world. What can we do to take advantage of this opportunity to gain popularity? Daniel Kurtzer?
Look, I actually think that's a good way to look at this issue, not so much to have recriminations for past behavior, but what can we learn from this? The United States sends mixed signals in its policy in the region. On the one hand, we are seen as the honest broker in Arab-Israeli peacemaking. On the other hand, much of the Arab street sees us as biased and perhaps even double-dealing in our support for Israel over Palestinian rights. We've used force in Iraq. We've used force in Afghanistan. And many Muslims wonder why we won't use force elsewhere in the world to promote our interests. And at the same time, we talk about democracy, and yet we probably have not done enough over the years to see at least the democratic processes grow in these countries. So even as we're dealing with this immediate crisis, there is an opportunity here to take stock and to talk to the people of the region, to talk to other governments, but also to talk to non-governmental organizations, civil society, and try to develop a more coherent approach, including a more intense focus on peacemaking in the Arab-Israeli arena.
Hannah Alam, I wonder, as you talk to people who've been in the streets, do they talk about, are they concerned about what the United States says one way or the other? Does it matter to them what the United States says?
Well, it matters. It's not the immediate concern. It's not what's at the forefront when you ask people, you know, what's on their mind these days. But certainly, you know, protesters show journalists tear gas canisters used by the police against them that say "Made in America." There's, you know, nobody is ignorant of the fact that that this is a regime that's been backed by the United States for, you know, since its inception. And honestly, I never heard a single person in this region describe, as the ambassador described, the United States as an honest broker in the Arab-Israeli peace process. I think that there would be a lot of disagreement on that from an Arab Middle Eastern standpoint here. However, I do agree there's an opportunity here to look at U.S. policy going ahead, and certainly that's what we're hearing from protesters who say there is a role for the United States, but first, you know, we've got to settle things down here. And, you know, first and foremost, they say you can't call for democratic reform and then turn a blind eye to the excesses of a regime like Mubarak's.
Joining us down the line from Vancouver in Canada is Tamer Mustafa, associate professor at the Simon Fraser University School for International Studies in Vancouver, where he focuses on religion, politics, and law in the Middle East. And thanks very much for being with us today.
Pleasure to be with you.
And I know you've spent a fair amount of time in Egypt and have been on the streets with protesters yourself a few years ago. We've heard these protesters described as, well, all kinds of people from all walks of life. Many of them, well, have known nobody in power except for Hosni Mubarak. Can you tell us a little bit more about who's protesting right now and which groups are engaged?
That's absolutely right. I mean, there have been periodic protests since 2003 against the regime, and those were always characterized by, you know, maybe several hundred or at the most several thousand very sort of politically engaged people from a variety of different political perspectives, but it was always sort of the same set of people. And the thing that is really extraordinary about what's happening right now, of course, is that it is involving a much larger swath of Egyptian society. So it's not just those who are normally engaged in political action, but it's really crossing over to the everyday citizen. We're crossing all class lines. We're crossing all political and ideological lines, and they're all asking for pretty much the same thing, which is that they want Mubarak to step down, and they want to see a new political system that will be a responsive government.
Hannah Alam, does that sound right to you?
Yes, absolutely. This and the spectrum that we're seeing out at these marches is extraordinary. I mean, this is a society divided. I mean, well, there are deep class divisions, economic divisions, military versus civilian divisions, and you're really seeing all walks of life out there.
Yet it's easy, or relatively easy, Tamer Mustafa, to agree on an anti-Mubarak agenda. What then happens if Mubarak goes?
Yeah, well, I think there is there's actually consensus that's emerging beyond just, of course, the foremost calls for Mubarak to step down. But there has been, variety of groups that are involved in the protests have agreed on a number of core principles. It's not just that Mubarak stepped down, but they'd like to see a new constitution, free and fair elections, and to have a responsive government. Of course, you know, at that stage, once Mubarak is gone, it will be difficult to. I mean, there will be obviously difficulties in terms of how those things are sort of put into place. But there's a remarkable harmony amongst opposition activists, the folks who are on the street, about what they want to see. And what they're calling for is really to have a responsive government. So, again, you know, it has been very notable, right, that we haven't seen different political trends, you know, leftists, Islamists, secularists, sort of pushing for different visions of what the state should look like. It's really been a remarkable harmony in terms of what they're calling for, and they're all calling for responsive government.
All right, let's get another caller in. This is Jerry. Jerry with us from Cookeville in Tennessee.
Hi. This is really wild. I mean, who would have thought, huh? I see this as kind of a replay of 1979. And the Muslim Brotherhood, they will, when this is all said and done, because Mubarak, I think, will be gone in this time next week. He'll probably be out of there. And the Muslim Brotherhood will come out of this on top. They might use all the other groups together, but they will coalesce these groups together, but they will come out on top, and they will use the anti-Israel and anti-USA slogans before long, because on CNN yesterday, they were showing young people who are already calling for the death of Israel. And I thought, well, this was supposed to be anti-Mubarak. Now it's turning into anti-Israel, and that's going to be kind of that's scary if this starts.
Tamer Mustafa, is he right? Is the Muslim Brotherhood poised to take advantage of this?
Well, there's a few things to say in response to that. The first is that there are many Egyptians would like to revisit the relationship with Israel. I think most Egyptians would, and that's not to say that most Egyptians want to see any state of war or any kind of increased tensions at all. Actually, I think that Egyptians are do not want to see antagonistic relationship. I do think that they would like to revisit the relationship between Egypt and America and Israel. But that's not to say that they won't want war or something like this. I think we need to be really careful in how we characterize this. The first thing to say is that what the Brotherhood would see in terms of wanting to revisit that relationship is no different from other opposition trends within Egypt. So even so, the secularist trends as well, leftists and liberals and so on, have a lot of the same problems with Egyptian foreign policy. Now, again, it does not mean that they want to have any kind of an antagonistic relationship. I think Egyptians are done with war and done with conflict, and they just simply want stability and to be able to feed their families, et cetera, et cetera. But the caller does raise a really important issue, and that is the Islamist boogeyman. And it's very clear that, for decades, this is the instrument, the rationale, the trope that the Mubarak regime has used.
Well, I would like to say something.
Rationalize staying into power. So I think we need to be very careful about getting ahead of ourselves in terms of, sort of scary scenarios that may play out.
Jerry, I'm sorry, you were going to say?
Yes, I was going to say that this is not a boogeyman, because the Muslim Brotherhood, they have called for the destruction of Israel. Now, I mean, that's just a matter of, those are facts.
I don't know that I agree with that fact, actually.
Oh, so they haven't called for the destruction of Israel?
No, not that I know of. I cannot think of any statements where they've called for the destruction of Israel at all, actually.
Well, actually, they have. I mean, all you really have to do is kind of check a little more on it. But
Daniel Kurtzer, I wonder if you wanted to weigh in on this.
Sure. There's a difference between sentiment and hard-headed analysis. I think we would all like to believe that the inchoate masses on the streets are all Democrats in the making, and probably a great majority of them could be. The problem is that they're, because of the absence of organized politics in Egypt, because the regime for so long has denied the ability of people to form political parties and to have freedom of expression, organized groupings have been forced underground, including the Muslim Brotherhood. So they are probably one of the most, if not the most, organized group in that society. And they have a very significant and clear intent, and that is the creation of an Islamist state. Now, Hamas, which considers itself the Muslim Brotherhood arm in Palestine, indeed has called for the destruction of the state of Israel. I'd have to go back and check the last time the Egyptian branch of the Muslim Brotherhood pronounced itself on this issue. But I have no doubt that their view of an Islamist state would cover not just Egypt, but also the historic area of Palestine and most other places in the Middle East. So, it's not really a question of the last statement of the Brotherhood. It's really a question of whether or not we perceive the Brotherhood as a potential partner in Egyptian politics. And I think one of the things that has galvanized the Egyptian military into the support that it's given Mubarak over the years is its concern not to allow the Muslim Brotherhood a step, a foot in the door that might allow it to actually exploit that foot and assume power at some point.
Jerry, thanks very much for the phone call. We'd also like to thank Hanna Alam for her time today, Cairo Bureau Chief for McClatchy Newspapers. Appreciate your being with us tonight, and take care of yourself tomorrow.
Thank you.
And also our thanks to Tamer Mustafa, Associate Professor at Simon Fraser University School for International Studies in Vancouver. He joined us on the phone from there. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And Daniel Kurtzer, former U.S. Ambassador to Egypt, is still with us. I wanted to ask you about your role as ambassador at this moment. Obviously, a big part of what an ambassador would do in a situation like this is report back to his Secretary of State and to the President of the United States on what's going on. But there's a lot of Americans in Egypt who are trying to get out. How much of that is your role?
Well, at a time like this, it becomes, in a sense, the only role that the embassy plays, which is the protection of American citizens and the assurance that we can provide the services necessary. My assumption is that Ambassador Margaret Scobie, the current ambassador, has marshaled all of the resources of the embassy to try to find out where the Americans are, to try to arrange safe transport to the airport to ensure that they're taken care of at the airport with respect to food and water, and also to see what can be done to arrange the charter flights. The embassy, in fact, will be judged on the basis of how well they do in this crisis, not so much by the political reporting, but how well they do in ensuring that American citizens are protected and that they're evacuated safely.
The Associated Press is reporting that Frank Wisner, another former U.S. ambassador to Egypt, has arrived in that company in the ground on Cairo, will be meeting with Egyptian officials to urge them to embrace broad economic and political changes. So former Ambassador Wisner might be taking on some of that policy role and leaving the current ambassador to deal with some of these logistical issues.
Well, Frank Wisner was one of our greatest ambassadors in Egypt, had developed a really terrific relationship with President Mubarak and other members of the regime, also was seen, interestingly, as a bit of a man of the people. He got to know a wide swaths of Egyptian society. So if, in fact, he is in Cairo for any kind of discussions, it's a wise move. I think he's not only a good listener, but not only a good reporter, but a good listener.
As your experience, Israel today agreed to let Egyptian forces go across the Suez Canal, go to Sinai, about two brigades, maybe 800 or I think two battalions, about 800 men, off to Sharm el-Sheikh. What might that be about?
Well, the Israelis, who have been uncharacteristically quiet in public during this crisis, are extraordinarily concerned in private. Their public posture does not tell you the degree to which they now perceive themselves in a very disadvantageous position. Look what happened in Lebanon with Hezbollah seeming to control who's running the government and how that government functions. The upheaval in Egypt, which has raised questions on the street about the longevity of the peace treaty or at least the relationship with Israel, particularly since 2005 when Israel withdrew from Gaza. There has been very good cooperation between Israel and Egypt to ensure that to try to ensure that smuggling of arms and so forth into Gaza from Egypt could be curbed. So the Israelis have very concrete interests here. This is not purely speculative on their part. They have worked well with their Egyptian counterparts, despite what is called a kind of cold peace. The peace treaty has remained intact. And the relationship has grown quite important in Israeli eyes. So I think in this case, the extraordinary move by Egypt to, in a sense, violate the treaty by moving military personnel into a zone in which they're not supposed to be stationed really does represent how important stability is to the state of Israel.
And finally, the importance of the Suez Canal. We just have a few seconds left, but this is an absolutely critical route for, well, all kinds of economic purposes.
Oh, for sure. And it's important for all of us, world commerce as well as regional powers. On the other hand, there's nothing to suggest that the demonstrators intend to harm Egypt's vital interests. Suez is both symbolic and critical for the Egyptian economy, and maybe untouchable.
Daniel Kurtzer, thanks very much for your time today. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Daniel Kurtzer served as U.S. ambassador to Egypt in 1997 to 2001 and to Israel in 2001 to 2005. He's currently at Princeton and joined us from a studio there. Stay with us. When we come back, Sharifa Rhodes Pitts on the neighborhood that became a mecca for Black America. Harlem is nowhere. This is NPR News.